Stories from California Cattle Country is produced by the California Cattlemen's Foundation and receives support from the California Cattle Council. We've created this podcast for those wanting to connect with the people and practices of far-flung ranches and dairies in California through hearing stories from and learning more about the families of cattle country. Now, as explained in the introduction, this podcast is tasked with communicating about the people and practices of California cattlemen and women. I understand there could be a perception that I could be, or this podcast could be, a mouthpiece for the cattlemen's industry. After all, I mean, they do pay me. I've mentioned before in earlier episodes, but it's important to acknowledge that where I go, provided it's within the state of California, and who I interview, or the focus or theme of those interviews, isn't controlled or even suggested by my employers. I'm tasked with telling these stories once every 2 weeks. I'm encouraged not to repeat producers, as it could be seem to be promoting one over another. Other than that, any story is fair game. Now, California is dynamic. It's an economic and political powerhouse. It's not always easy to do business in, especially if your business pre-exists the existence of the state. Many ranchers and landowners in the state, the ones intent on preserving their properties and the ecosystems within them, have made some strange bedfellows, specifically with institutions with intentions on preserving California's natural landscapes. Some of these people may be considered, or consider themselves, environmentalists. In all honesty, calling them strange bedfellows just addresses a perception about ranchers and sensical environmentalists. What I've seen over the last 2 years visiting cattle ranches reinforces something that I was honestly surprised by. That is that ranchers hold most, if not all, of the same opinions of the same people that you assume they'd never jive with. I offer this episode up as an example of unexpected synergy. As I stated, California isn't especially easy to do business in, especially if your business is in agriculture. In the last years, I've met these strange bedfellows, people cognizant of their issues and wishes and willing to work the problem. In this episode, we speak with Elena DeLacy, Executive Director of the American River Conservancy, about working with California ranchers in an effort to preserve critical ecosystems through land trusts in the American and Cosumnes River water basins. I'm Ryan Donahue, and this is Stories from California Cattle Country.
Hi, this is Elena.
Hey, Elena. This is Ryan from California Cattlemen's.
Good morning. My name is Elena DeLacy. I'm the Executive Director of American River Conservancy. I've been with the organization since 2003. I started as a project intern, actually. I was still a student at UC Davis. I was studying environmental biology and management. And I kind of stumbled across the conservancy because I was giving violin lessons in Placerville and the surrounding communities. And one of my first students was Alan Ergot's son. Alan Ergot was our previous executive director. And we got to talking about conservation and land and the watershed. I found out about land trusts that way. I started an internship. Once I graduated, it turned into a full-time job. I've been there ever since. My first permanent position at the organization was conservation project coordinator. And I have served in various roles since then. I was the stewardship director. I've been the associate director. And in 2019, when Alan retired, I became ARC's second executive director.
There's two things that were kind of surprising to me was how land trusts haven't, or in this function, haven't been used for all that long, but also your longevity with one organization is pretty remarkable. What's the reasoning behind sticking with the same crew over 20 years?
Well, I really love this area. I love the area that I live in. I grew up in Sacramento in kind of a suburban neighborhood. I would always, with my parents, come up to Placerville and the Camino area, Apple Hill. My grandmother lived in South Lake Tahoe. We would always meet here. It was like the halfway point. And the gold country always was very appealing to me. As I got older, I really started to appreciate this region, Placerville and the surrounding area, because it's really close to the mountains, the Sierra Nevada, but it's also very close to the ocean. And so you have this, all of the nature experiences in one place. It's pretty phenomenal. My family also lives close by and I have children. So it's really nice to be able to raise your children in a place where you're 45 minutes drive from grandparents.
what's interesting to me, there's statewide land trusts, and then there's ones that are like have boundaries, and yours has boundaries. So it's, you know, American River, I think Consumnes River Basin, right? California is so complex and so diverse geographically, by, you know, biologically. What makes this place unique and special to you, whether it's wildlife or even topography? Like, what do you love about it?
I would have to say my top favorite ecosystem in California is oak woodland, followed by a close second in the riparian areas in our state. There's something about the foothills and the oak woodlands of El Dorado County and Placer County and in the Upper American River and Upper Cosumnes River watersheds that's really just so beautiful. It feels like home. These areas are so rich in diversity in terms of wildlife. They also are one of the most threatened ecosystems in California, and just in terms of being gobbled up by subdivision and development. I think it's really important that we protect these areas because they're such important hotspots for wildlife. And people also like to recreate in these areas. And the foothills are very close to major population centers. I think that's an added benefit. And then there's also this rural feeling when you drive through El Dorado County along Highway 49, you know, you're in the Gold Country Belt and it's beautiful and it's kind of this timeless experience. And you can kind of imagine what it was like 100 years ago, 200 years ago, what it might have been like pre-European settlement. The way it works is we, of course, work with willing landowners who want to see their land protected in some way. We protect land through a variety of methods. We can acquire land in fee, so that means just acquiring the land outright. We also work to acquire conservation easements. So in that situation, the land trust would hold a conservation easement on the land. The landowner would still own the land, but it would be subject to some restrictions. So most frequently, the restrictions are things like you can't subdivide or develop the property. You may not be able to build new roads or develop minerals. That's what a conservation easement does. It basically acts as deed restrictions and it runs with the land so that if you sell the land to someone else or you pass it on to your heirs, that conservation easement always stays there and is a legal instrument that protects the land in perpetuity.
I've been thinking about this. I don't know if there's a definition for it. I'm sure that there is. But the idea that mankind kind of interfacing with the natural spaces. There are a lot of people that I think are very, very passionate about nature and think that it should be how it was 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago.
There's this really unique concept, and I think it's a really great concept. It's called reconciliation ecology. And I don't know if I'm going to define it correctly, but to me, what it means is we can't go back to the way it was 1,000 years ago, right? Like it's just not realistic. So we have to reconcile what's happened up until now, historically, ecologically speaking, and realize how can we maintain a landscape and an assemblage of species that retains ecosystem function. You know, all these things that we appreciate and benefit from as people, water quality benefits, biodiversity, the ability for oak woodlands to hold water and maintain soil health, store carbon. There's all these things. And, you know, pollinators, yes, there's always going to be things we're dealing with and managing as humans. And so we have to kind of think of it in the terms of how, what is the best way we can manage these things, knowing that we can't go back to the way it was 1,000 years ago? You know, how can we manage fire in our landscapes better? How can we plan better? It's not if there will be fires, it's when there will be fires in our region. And it's just being able to come to grips with that and face reality and manage the land in a way that addresses those realities. We still have threatened and endangered species. We still have wonderful areas that have been relatively untouched and remain intact. The vast, large landscapes that we have annual grasses and weeds and things like that that we can manage, but I don't think we'll ever eradicate those things. So
in a lot of the work that you've been doing for what, over 20 years, you've partnered and worked with ranchers, and ranchers have cows. Can you tell me the benefits of working with ranchers and why these animals can be beneficial and helpful for maintaining biodiversity and the structure of these ecosystems?
I think one of the things that I have seen be beneficial in terms of grazing, I've worked with many different livestock producers, from cattle to goats to sheep. I'm just going to talk about the broad benefits of grazing. For us as a land trust, we're managing thousands of acres. Right now, we manage 13,400 acres. I mentioned wildfire. There's a huge threat, catastrophic wildfire. We've experienced that so much in the past 5-10 years. So there's that benefit. The grazing really does help reduce fuel load. Where we've had grazing in the on land that we manage, we do see reductions in certain types of invasive weeds like Medusa head and star thistle in some cases. Those are really tangible benefits. There are ranches that we manage where we have seen increases in soil carbon. We have been working with Point Blue Conservation Science to monitor soil carbon and vegetation health. They help us monitor an assemblage of birds that are kind of like focal species in the oak woodland that tell us how healthy the ecosystems are where there's rangeland. We've been a part of the Rangeland Monitoring Network for, I think, 5 or 6 years now, and we've definitely seen some increases and improvements in biodiversity on some of the ranches that we manage that have cattle grazing.
I think people want to ask more questions and things. And one of the ones that's fascinating to me is that you can't do this for free. I think people be interested in where the money comes from.
Most of our funding for land acquisition and conservation. So first of all, I kind of wanted to explain how our acquisition program works. And when we're doing land projects, we have specific strategic goals that we want to accomplish. We want to have connectivity to other existing protected lands. A lot of the times we're focusing on land near rivers or important tributaries to the rivers that we work in, working strategically. And then we only work with willing landowners. If someone's not willing to work with us, well, then that's not a good opportunity for us. We're always kind of on the proactive side in terms of working with folks that want to see their land protected. We get land appraised for fair market value. We write grants. Most of our funding comes from competitive grants from state agencies. The majority of the funding that we get for land protection comes from the Wildlife Conservation Board, Natural Resources Agency. We've gotten some funding in the past from Sierra Nevada Conservancy has been a huge funder of our projects in the past as well. They're another state agency, of course. And then we're also working with CAL FIRE. They have a forest legacy program. We've been successful in being awarded grants from that program. And occasionally we do work with federal programs, but most of our funding is state grant programs. And we also bring community private donor money to the table too. We oftentimes reach out to our membership and supporter base because not all of the costs of acquisition can be funded from these state grants. So we oftentimes have to raise funds for appraisals and due diligence work. We have to do title review. We have escrow closing costs and all of the staff time it takes to make these projects happen.
There's the possibility that there's landowners that own a bunch of land and it's fenced in. Could you speak specifically about what's the importance of having grazers on those properties?
There can be opportunities to increase native plant biodiversity. And in areas like large oak woodland landscapes, we can utilize grazing as a tool to target invasive weeds. So things like Medusa head and goatgrass and star thistle, things like that. If you graze it at the right time, you can see decreases in those populations. And maybe you might see increases in other native wildflowers or native grass populations. We also work with grazers to protect riparian areas as well. So if you situate water and salt minerals in areas where it's away from riparian vegetation, you can also kind of entice the cows to move to areas that you want to have grazed a little bit more heavily, and that can help increase soil carbon in those areas. It could also help decrease the amount of non-native weeds. So there's various tools we use. A lot of the ranchers we work with are just already implementing these things. They've been implementing these measures for decades. And so, you know, they really have a feel for what works on the land. Long-term stewardship of rangeland, taking care of it and making sure you have forage and feed over the winter and in those months where you have a lot of dry weather is important. So that's why we encourage long-term leases with grazers and ranchers that we've been working with for a long time. And they take really good care of the land and it's less work for us.
You mentioned something about seeing some certain species. I don't know if you're talking about bird species or mm-hmm. that are kind of indicative of, it's like the opposite of the canary in the coal mine, right? Mm-hmm. You see these species, you see these animals, like, and what I'm looking for is kind of what are your opposite canaries in the coal mine when you see these fellas like moving around an ecosystem?
Oh, okay. I'm going to mention a couple and hopefully my bird biologist friends will agree with me because I did not study up on the focal species.
And they're not particular at all, turns out.
Yeah.
The birders.
Yeah. Well, I know that so scrub jays. I'm gonna mention four species. Scrub jays are, when you see scrub jays in an oak woodland, you know that you have a good shrub layer somewhere and that there's enough food for scrub jays to eat. Scrub jays are, a lot of people like to hate them, but they are actually the landscape architects of the oak woodland. And so when you have scrub jays in an ecosystem, you know something's happening that's right. They actually facilitate the recruitment or germination of young oaks. They will bury acorns everywhere and then forget about them, and then you'll have baby oak trees coming up. So that's a really good sign. Another really good sign, again, connected to acorns, is the acorn woodpecker. This is an animal that you often see on ranch lands, and you'll see the granaries on like fence posts or dead trees where they'll store acorns, and they actually farm them for bugs. So they put acorns in there and then they like turn them around, and like bugs will colonize acorns, and they do eat bugs too. So that's a really interesting species that if you see it, there's enough oaks and insects to support their colony. They're colonial also, so they work together, extended family units. Another one that's important is the flicker, the northern flicker. This is another woodpecker in the woodpecker family. They also forage a lot in the understory for insects. And so when you have a good insect population, you have healthy soil, you'll see more flickers. There are so many birds I want to mention now that I'm going through my list. But another one that...
You got four.
Yeah, one more.
Yeah, you got to pick your favorite. Yeah.
California quail. California quail is an important species because they're ground nesters. So they require a lot of diversity in the ecosystem. They like to be near riparian areas, so they need water, and they're always going around foraging, eating bugs and things like that. These are all there's so many more. There's secondary cavity nesters, little songbirds that are also indicative of healthy oak woodlands, because that means you have older oak trees. But those four are really some of my favorites, and those really mean that you have a robust, healthy ecosystem.
Last thing, I don't know how long how long the El Dorado Ranch has been mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm. So just about that history, when we talk about ranchers, they're, you know, mm-hmm. I say they're squirrely. Like if I cold call a rancher, I'm like, hey, can I come to your ranch? They're like, no, you know,
no.
And I agree. Like it totally makes sense. Can you just tell me just a little bit about the history of that project?
So we first started working on conservation of El Dorado Ranch, I think it was about 2010 or 2012, in that time frame. And it was back when Alan Ergot was our executive director. One of my jobs has always been making maps. I like to do GIS. And So I was helping with the maps at that point. The property actually has gone through some ownership changes over the last 30, 40 years. It's been owned by a number of different real estate developers. At that time, it was completely owned by Angelo Sakopoulos, AKT Properties.
Of course, yeah.
A prominent developer.
He comes up a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't remember when he purchased the property, but it had been, it's 7,500 acres altogether. And so it represents one of the largest intact holdings of blue oak woodland in El Dorado County by a single landowner. And so we're really interested in protecting that oak woodland landscape. El Dorado County's identified it in their general plan as a priority conservation area for oak woodlands. California Department of Fish and Wildlife was interested in creating a wildlife area along the Cosumnes River. It fronts the Cosumnes River habitat for wild Chinook salmon. And so it has all these great habitat attributes. We started working with Angelo, and he has been just a willing seller ever since the beginning. I think since even before Angelo purchased the property, the Nielsen family has been grazing cattle out there probably for, I want to say, 50 or more years. But they own a ranch that's adjacent to the El Dorado Ranch. They have their homestead there. They know the property like the back of their hands. Tim Nielsen, who I work with most frequently, is always out there every day doing something. And they actually have been wonderful to work with. I just want to applaud their stewardship of the property for decades. It's been phenomenal. So, I mean, it's a testament to how good stewardship and good land management can make a positive impact on the landscape. 7,500 acres is a lot to acquire in one fell swoop. So what we have done up until now is acquire chunks of the property in, you know, kind of 1,000-acre chunks in phases. We are currently working on phase four, and we are looking at a closing escrow on phase four by the end of this year. Phase four is about 1,025 acres. Waiting until the end of November, we're hoping we'll get the last $2.7 million awarded to us by Wildlife Conservation Board, but altogether it's a $4.7 million acquisition project for phase four. You know, I think Tim Nielsen has been just such a patient person as we go through this process, but it's taken over almost, it's going to be a dozen years now that we've worked on this, that been a partner on the landscape. And, you know, I really want to just also say that we've had a couple rough years. I know Tim's had a rough year. We had the Caldor fire in, gosh, 2021 that decimated most of his high country grazing, his grazing allotments up on the El Dorado National Forest. And so he's had to really make some sacrifices, but he's done a great job throughout it all managing it, and can always count on them to have a really good idea of what's going on out there. And you know, the fact that there's someone out there almost every single day keeping an eye out on things is priceless. We really appreciate that service as well.
I want to thank you for your time on a Saturday. I didn't realize that you also had an event tomorrow too, so that I know that's a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me know if you're going to get out there on the land. I'd love to tag along. And Tim is a wonderful storyteller. He's a wealth of information. And okay.
That's pretty good. I think it went well.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ryan.
We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.